Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, you might say that two trials rolled into one opened at Guantanamo Bay this week. One is of the defendant, Salim Ahmad Hamdan. He stands accused of transporting weapons for al-Qaeda and helping Osama bin Laden to escape U.S. forces after the September 11th attacks. But also on trial, really, is the system of justice under which Hamdan is being tried. It's the first war crimes tribunal being held by the U.S. since just after World War II, and it's being conducted under highly controversial rules designed by the Bush administration. Most notably, perhaps, is that the outcome of the trial really doesn't matter. If Mr. Hamdan is convicted, he could be sentenced to life in prison for his crimes, and if he's acquitted, well, same thing, indefinite detention because the U.S. has designated him an enemy combatant. So why have a trial at all? Joining us with her views at the end of the first week of the Hamdan trial is New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer. She was on the station earlier in the week for her new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Obviously, she is a big critic of the post-September 11th justice system. Jane, thanks for coming back on WNYC today. Hello.
I'm really glad to be with you. Thanks.
First, war crimes tribunals conducted by the military are nothing new. Is the system that Hamdan is being tried under unique in U.S. history?
Well, it's kind of an ad hoc system here. It's what's changed since the last time the country tried doing this is there's now something called the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which has procedures set out for how to have such kinds of war crimes trials. And what the Bush administration did was ignore the Uniform Code of Military Justice and create its own system here. So this is kind of a unique test of the whole post 9/11 legal system set up for terrorism by the Bush administration.
So let's go down some of these examples, and we'll open the phones and comments page on this. If you want to call in on the first week of the Gitmo trial, if you've been following it or just have a question for Jane Mayer, 646-778-3729, 646-778-3729, 646-SPUDRAY, if that's easy to remember, 646-778-3729, or comment at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, Jane, this catch-22 that I mentioned, that if he's convicted, he'll probably get life in prison. If he's acquitted, maybe the exact same thing, because the Bush administration says it may hold him until the end of the war on terror as an enemy combatant. Is that different from other U.S. war crimes trials historically?
Well, yeah, usually when you're acquitted, and then you are a free person. So, yes, the situation is kind of double jeopardy-like in the views of critics, and it's not the only way that this is different, though. I mean, first of all, to go back to your question about, you know, how long could they hold him and what would be the difference, the thing is the Bush administration's never defined what victory would be in the war on terror. So we don't really have a picture of when you could be let out. What would it mean when it's over? We've really never had that. So,
right, there'll always be some terrorism in the world.
Well, there has been for hundreds of years, so it seems unfortunately likely that there will be for hundreds more years. So the question is then, what will happen to people like this if they are acquitted? The irony here, I think one of the other ironies, is that there were two other people picked up with Hamdan at the same time, including his boss, who was arguably a more important al-Qaeda figure. Hamdan's just the driver for Osama bin Laden. And those two other figures who were picked up at the same time have been let free and have returned back to Morocco, actually. And the reason that they are not in the same boat that he's in is that, unlike him, they didn't cooperate with interrogators. So they never gave statements that incriminated themselves. And Hamdan, on the other hand, the man who's on trial, was very cooperative with interrogators. They didn't have to, you know, put thumb screws on or anything like that. He thought he was in hot water, and he tried to cut deals that would get himself out of hot water by helping the United States officials when they interrogated him. So he gave them all of the incriminating information against himself and also a lot of other useful information about Al-Qaeda. And because he cooperated, he's in worse legal jeopardy than the people who didn't, who they didn't have anything on, so they let them go.
Well, that's interesting. But, Jane, one of the first acts of the judge in this case, Navy Captain Keith Allred, was to bar from evidence many of Hamdan's tape confessions because of the, quote, highly coercive, the judge's words, interrogation techniques that elicited them. Do you know what some of those techniques were? Because, I mean, this would seem to indicate that Hamdan maybe really didn't cooperate quite so willingly if he had to have stuff coerced out of him.
Well, there were sort of two phases of his interrogation. The first was when he was held by the military in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And that was a pretty coercive period of detention for the U.S. I mean, it just typically. And what they did was they hogtied him and put him in a hood and kept him in isolation pretty much 24 hours a day. I think there's a report that he spent 8 months actually in isolation, which is considered a kind of psychological coercion, and he was, you know, chained up in most of the time. I think there was on one of the videos there are pictures of U.S. Servicemen holding him in kind of a hammer hold while he's being interrogated. So some of that was excluded, and again, this is going to be this is a really important test case of how we're going to be able to move forward in trying these suspects, because in truth, Hamdan's interrogation is not a very coercive one compared to some of the really coercive ones. It was not particularly brutal or outstandingly so. And yet, even so, the judge has excluded a quantity of information that he gave up. Most of what he gave up, though, according to the FBI officers who testified, one of whom is named Ali Soufan, who's a real expert on Al-Qaeda in particular. He's a native Arab speaker, and he was at the FBI for many years. He's out now, but he's made many of the best cases against Al-Qaeda. He's kind of an amazing character in his own right. And he got Hamdan to just talk to him just by basically being respectful and conversational with him. And Hamdan opened up to Ali Soufan and told him all kinds of things about what he got to see about bin Laden and behind the scenes in this, you know, bizarre world of terrorism that he was part of during the years that he was driving bin Laden. So lots of that is still admissible. It was just plain given freely, and it is self-incriminating because, as Ali Soufan testified in the trial, unlike any other case that he's been involved in these newfangled prosecutions, the defendants are not read their Miranda rights. They're not told that they have the right to remain silent, and they're not warned that they can incriminate themselves by doing this. And so Hamdan gave all the rope that he's now hanging from.
But they don't have those rights. I mean, they're not suspects in, you know, a robbery in Brooklyn. They're suspected members of a terrorist organization.
Right. I mean, and so they're not given the rights of regular criminal defendants, and that was one of the key decisions made by the Bush administration early on. But they've been taken outside of the criminal justice system. They've also been taken out of the ordinary military uniform code of military justice, and that's why he's the sort of the guinea pig case in this new system that's been set up. And so he's, but again, one of the things that's so interesting is that he's being used to pretty much indict himself, whereas the people who remain silent have been let off. It's very much the other case that it resembles in that way is, if people remember, the John Walker Lynn case.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that he was convicted of was information that he gave in a statement to CNN mostly and to other interrogators.
And he was a U.S. citizen. He was the American Taliban, so to speak.
That's right. And so, you know, it looks like a regular similar trial in some ways. The judge has a black robe, and there are sort of either wood-paneled chambers, but the rules are completely different.
And my guest on WNYC is Jane Mayer, New Yorker staff writer, author of the new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. But this is not a book interview. She's been on talking about her book on the station a few times on different shows over the last week, and we are talking now about the first week of the Salim Hamdan trial, the man allegedly the driver for Osama bin Laden, the first trial of a detainee at Guantanamo Bay. Now, Jane, the fact that the military is the prosecutor, but that the judge and all the jurors are also selected from active military personnel, do you think that makes the trial fundamentally unfair, or is that just the way of military justice and is actually unremarkable in this case?
Well, it is different, as I said, from the Uniform Code of Military Justice court-martials. The way these things were originally set up, the prosecutor it just has so many more powers than an ordinary prosecutor would have. And the other thing that's interesting is that if there is a conviction and the defendant wants to appeal, it's up to the president whether or not he wants to grant any kind of appeal in this
case.
Really? Yeah. So that there have been some very different rules in this thing. I thought maybe it would be interesting to talk a little bit about who Hamdan is, mm-hmm. and what he's charged with in particular.
Right, and of course the lawyers for him are arguing that he's just a low-level assistant with a fourth-grade education who just needed a job. The prosecution is arguing he was a trusted aide to bin Laden, trusted with bin Laden's physical safety, trusted to be told about the 9/11 attacks and more, and also that he had two missiles in his possession at the time of his arrest, which he doesn't dispute. And the prosecution said they could only be intended to be shot at American warplanes. He says he just had them for personal protection as he was trying to flee the war in Afghanistan. What else do you want to say about Hamdan?
I think the key question is in this trial is he a major player, an al-Qaeda true believer, somebody who is a serious terrorist threat, or is he and was he a part of the inner circle of bin Laden, or is he just a servant who is getting paid $200 a week, who's kind of just fell into this position and doesn't really know much himself? And what the defense lawyers brought up this week was they said if a general committed a war crime and his driver was just along driving him, would you find the driver himself guilty of a war crime? And the answer would be no. But so it's very important for the case to be able to show that he himself was in some ways a participant and knowledgeable about these war crimes that bin Laden committed. And the most incriminating information really that's come out so far is that Hamdan was there on 9/11 and witnessed and overheard a conversation in which bin Laden was speaking with his number two aide-de-camp, Ayman Zawahiri, and to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the sort of the tactical planner of the 9/11 attacks. And in those conversations, bin Laden actually said he was feeling terrific because 3,000 people, innocent people, had died in those attacks instead of the 1,500 that he had anticipated. Mm. So, I mean, it's a, you know, for anyone, New Yorker like myself or otherwise, it's a very chilling conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And he overheard this. So, but again, does that make him than a central terrorist? They've got much more serious al-Qaeda members down in Guantanamo, and they have not dared put them on trial yet because these questions of how they were treated are going to be even more complicated.
Jim in Cranford, I think, has an analogy to go with what you were just describing. Jim?
Yes, the analogy is prosecuting the driver for Osama bin Laden is like prosecuting Bobby Baccalari instead of Tony Soprano.
Well, and should Bobby be prosecuted too? I mean, was he a member of the same conspiracy?
I guess what my question is, though, is could we be trying bin Laden in absentia before we try any of the other possible associates?
Well, you know, Bin Laden has long been indicted in our ordinary criminal system, even from before 9/11. I don't know, you know, I mean, I think he's been well convicted in advance in the court of world opinion, so I'm not really sure how much we would get out of that in particular. But it is interesting that they started at such a low level. Another interesting thing is that typically in war crimes trials, conspiracy is you know, which would be what you would think would involve somebody like a driver, is not a war crime because pretty much all soldiers could be convicted of conspiracy. They're all fighting on the same side. So it is not traditionally an actual criminal charge that you can bring against somebody in a war crime.
Jim, thanks for your call. 646-778-3729. 646-778-3729 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You know, it's funny that you mentioned the rules of war there, because did you see that just as the trial was getting underway, Attorney General Mukasey from the Bush administration asked Congress to pass a law barring Guantanamo detainees from ever appearing in a domestic courtroom, and also, and this may be even more interesting, asking Congress to reaffirm that the United States remains in armed conflict with al-Qaeda. Just days after 9/11, Congress passed, I guess, a resolution to that effect, that the United States is in armed conflict with al-Qaeda, and the Bush administration wants Congress to reaffirm that. Is that interesting to you?
It certainly is, because this, of course, is just as the Supreme Court has ruled, saying that these detainees have a right to appeal whatever process happens down in Guantanamo into the United States courts. And so what Mukasey is basically saying, it's kind of a power play where he's saying, take the action out of the courts and put it in the hands of the politicians in Congress. And it's, I think, not coincidental that this happens right now as we're facing an election, because pretty much every time there's been, we've been close to an election, this national security issue has been raised by the Republicans in Congress some way or another in such a way that they will be, the Democrats are put on the defensive. They don't want to take a stance that looks like they're being soft on terrorism. It always puts them in a corner. So I think it's a way for the Bush administration to try to protect itself against court rulings that might not go their way.
Although if they're doing this to coincide with the presidential campaign after holding Hamdan for 6 years, it's kind of curious that they would do it in the last two weeks of July, when it's going to get pretty well buried.
Well, I mean, these trials are moving ahead, and I think that the nightmare for them would be that that any kind of conviction might be overturned once it reaches U.S. courts,
right,
and show again that the process that they've set up is in the eyes of critics anyway, a sort of a star chamber.
But something I don't understand about asking Congress to redeclare war, the Bush administration claims that al-Qaeda fighters are not entitled to Geneva Convention protections because they are something called illegal enemy combatants. But by declaring war on them, don't we turn them into a kind of opposing army rather than a group of outlaws?
Well, they—you would think so ordinarily, but that's not how they've defined it. They basically did something really different here after 9/11, and that's what I was trying to write about in my book. It breaks with American tradition, which either treats defendants or enemies as either prisoners of war, or it treats them as criminal defendants. But they basically took this special group of people and defined them as kind of outside any law. They put them in what the British law court said famously was a legal black hole. And so the argument is about trying to keep them in that. And the question about declaring war again is a matter of empowering the White House to do what it wants to do, because it makes Bush the commander-in-chief, and it gives him augmented powers when he's the commander-in-chief. So it's a way of trying to get Congress, again, put them on the spot before the election and you know, they make them rally around the flag and rally around the White House.
Fred in Rockland, you're on WNYC with Jane Mayer. Hello.
Yes, Jane. I just wanted to mention that the New York Times story about this this situation did state that Bin Laden did turn to him and say, "Did you hear what I just said to Zaghari?" So there is one source that says that he definitely did tell him directly. Secondly, you know, the Geneva Convention is so strict in its provisions. I mean, these people do not wear. It says that to be recognized under the conditions of the Geneva Convention, you have to wear a military uniform. You have to be part of a unit structure, and there has to be a general command structure, none of which these terrorists fit. So they really don't come under the Geneva Convention or the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
But let's linger on that. Let me linger on that for a minute,
yeah,
Fred.
Why
should that be the standard for a code of international law of war, whether somebody's wearing a uniform or not, and whether somebody's in a combat brigade organized in a traditional way?
Because then he can act as a terrorist. He can hide behind women and children. He can fade into the civilian population.
Like uniformed soldiers don't do that?
Yes, but they are recognizable. You see the uniform. You see them carrying their guns, as this man was carrying a missile, a surface-to-air missile. So it's very recognizable that they are a member of a military unit.
Can I say something,
Jane,
about this,
ahead.
Which is interesting? I mean, I understand certainly there is a sort of an issue about terrorists that's kind of like neither fish nor fowl. You know, traditionally before 9/11, we treated them as criminals, and that's what Europe treats them as. But in truth, people misunderstand that Geneva Conventions actually has a whole other category for what's called illegal enemy combatants, and they are spies and saboteurs, people who do not wear uniforms. And there's basically the rules for everybody under any kind of person caught in armed conflict in the Geneva Conventions. So under the spies and saboteurs, which is what you could look at the terrorists as, they're very tough rules for what you can do. They are allowed to have a very minimal kind of hearing where it's determined by the military whether or not they're guilty. And if they're guilty, they can actually be shot. I have to think that the Bush administration did not fully understand the Geneva Conventions when they threw them out, because they didn't give those basic hearings to anyone. And what they wound up with were a number of defendants who just were mistakes. And by our government's own count, that's true. The CIA went down and took a look at it and said, you know, there are a third of the people in Guantanamo were innocent. They could have treated them under this other convention, which is called the Fourth Convention. And so there actually are strict rules for dealing with people like this, which they, I think, didn't use. And the question is, did they come up with a better system down in Guantanamo? That's what we're trying to figure out.
And I've read that the people in the military justice system are not thrilled about the new rules that the Bush administration and Cheney and them came up with along the way, and that they may actually want to make a point, maybe including this Navy captain, Judge Allred, make a point to the Bush administration that military justice is actually more just than what they're being asked to do here. Do you
very
think there's
much
that kind
so.
Of...
There's a very strong feeling in the military. I mean, I don't think so much so that they would sacrifice the an attempt to try. I mean, I'm sure they're trying to convict Hamdan, but as best they can. But the whole system down there has just been completely plagued, almost to the point of dysfunctionality. One after another, major military figures involved in the prosecution and the defense have stood up and said, "This is a kangaroo court. We don't want to participate in this even."
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a tremendous problem, and that's why I think they're starting with a very low level defendant rather than risking it on somebody like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which will really, truly be a tough test down there.
Before you go, one way or the other, President McCain or President Obama will inherit the Gitmo detainees and the question with what to do with them as of next January 20th. When Obama was on his European rock star tour, he didn't really stake out a position, it seemed to me. While he talked about the U.S. becoming closer to Europe, he also defended the war on terror, I thought, without quite using that phrase, and didn't say one way or another whether the U.S. would go to the European system of viewing these people as criminals rather than enemy combatants. But if he indicated in either direction, it seemed to be that he would continue the war on terror model.
Well, I've asked people in McCain's camp too about this, and they say that McCain never uses the words war on terror. He doesn't really regard it as a war. At least that's what I'm told. So it may be that they both will. I feel like we don't know enough, and I wish reporters would ask them more about this. But whether they'll revert to the criminal model. I mean, Europe basically thinks we're flattering terrorists by calling them warriors. They want to be seen as warriors, and in fact, they're just mass murderers and heinous criminals. The one line that Obama got one of his biggest applause at in Berlin was when he said he was going to end torture, and so he and McCain have spoken out against that, and they both said they want to close Guantanamo. What they won't say is the hard stuff is, okay, so what are you going to replace it with? And I think we need some answers on those things.
Jane Mayer, New Yorker staff writer, author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals, here at the end of the first week of the first trial of a Guantanamo detainee. We plan to do another segment at the end of week two, a week from now. Jane, thanks so much for doing this with
us. It's so great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. Bloomberg and Gates turn some of their billions toward a global anti-smoking effort. Stay with us.